On May 1st, 2010, the quiet in the village of Oak Beach, Long Island, was broken by the screams of a young woman who was seen running out of one of its houses and then disappeared. The seven-month search for her resulted in the discovery of 11 sets of human remains in and around Gilgo Beach, Long Island. Four complete bodies had been wrapped in burlap and buried close to one another. They were all women in their 20s who'd advertised as escorts on Craigslist. In Lost Girls, an Unsolved Mystery, Robert Kolker, a New York Magazine contributing editor, tells the stories of a number of the young women murdered and traces the investigations into their killings, which remain unsolved to this day. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Kolker to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
In the first part of your book, you tell the stories of each of five girls, first under their names and then under their work names. Was it hard to get that information?
Yeah, I was basically starting from zero when working on the book. I had written a cover story for New York Magazine called A Serial Killer in Common, which came out about 2 years ago in the thick of the search for bodies. And this was the first story to bring family members of five of the women together and see them interact personally with one another. And that opened the door for me to explore their worlds, the family's worlds and the women's worlds.
Were the family members open with you?
At first, they were very guarded. It had been a long road for them. Some of them had gone for years without law enforcement or anyone caring about the disappearance of their loved one. And now they were caught up in the middle of a national media moment, and I had to be very sensitive to that. Part of them, it was really a catch-22 for them. Part of them really was, they were afraid that the case would go cold again, and so they wanted attention. But the other part of them sensed that, you know, their control over the story of their lives and their loved ones' lives was being lost. And so I needed to spend a lot of time with them and work hard to be as sensitive as possible to those concerns.
Well, there were also certain embarrassments involved in their stories.
Certainly, but I think one of the things that I had the luxury of doing in a book like this is to sit for a long time with everyone and sort of make the larger point that nobody's perfect and nobody fits into these storybook archetypes that we have, least of all prostitutes. They weren't good girls. They weren't bad girls. They weren't devils and they weren't angels. They were people who I think readers might recognize a little bit if they read the book.
Are we going to call them prostitutes or do we want to call them what they would have called themselves, paid escorts?
I stuck with escorts. I just don't think that anyone self-identifies with that word, although I certainly don't want to be categorical there. Maybe some of your listeners might. But it seemed to be what they were using. The word prostitute and prostitution pops up in the book, but not commonly.
But in the end, it is a form of prostitution.
Well, certainly. And
this is like what we used to call girls, in a sense, except they're online call girls.
Right. I think that the terminology makes a difference because the career or the perception of the career has been changing a little bit because of the internet. This is something that I get into by telling the stories of the women and that I wrote about more explicitly in an op-ed in the Times. It's about how the internet makes it seem safer and definitely makes it more anonymous, and it allows a whole population of people across the country to consider doing this when they might not have considered doing it a few years ago.
It also allows these women to get past the old structure of prostitution with pimps.
Absolutely. And some of the women I wrote about, they would never have signed on with an escort service. They would never have joined forces with a pimp. But here they could be their own boss and set their own hours and work once a month if they wanted to.
In order to interview the people who were related to these women, you had to go into some pretty dark places on occasion, mostly to talk to pimps or sex and drug dealers. Were you ever afraid?
There is a moment in the book where I'm walking through Times Square very late at night with a former escort, and she's showing me places where she and her close friend Melissa Barthelemy, who is one of the victims in this case, used to work, and they spent a lot of time there, and I was grateful to her for showing me a place I'd been to millions of times with new eyes. But of course, we're walking down the street and
you mean Times Square, the place that they were. They didn't stand on the corner, did they?
Well, in this phase of Melissa's life, they worked the streets and then she moved to Craigslist. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to learn a little bit about how that shift happened for them. So we're in Times Square and I'm walking down the street and I'm with Crizia, you know, the source for this part of the book. And sure enough, we run into some of her old friends, including her old boyfriend and pimp, and there's an altercation, and it's over quicker than what we just, discussed right now. And only in hindsight did I freak out and realize, boy, that was dangerous.
The pimp was angry because she no longer was in his stable.
And yet the two of them have had a very on-again, off-again relationship. She's been back with him since then, not working for him, but as a girlfriend. And so they're going to stay in each other's lives for a while. They have a few children together.
What do the lost girls of your book, Maureen, Melissa, Shannon, Megan, and Amber, have in common, other than the fact that they worked as escorts?
This is what drew me to these stories. These are women who never knew one another. Their families never knew one another. They grew up in towns up and down the Eastern Seaboard, all far away from one another. And yet there were some similar elements to their stories. They all were from working class communities that weren't struggling not so long ago. They all sort of, in hindsight, they sort of fit the prototype that might be in a book like The Unwinding by George Packer. And you read, critics like Timothy Noah write about the gap, not just the gap between rich and poor, but the gap between the middle class and the working class, and how difficult lives are down at the working class level. But you don't see much of that actually playing out in the way of narrative. And I thought that apart from telling a murder mystery, which is what Lost Girls is, the first half of the book could really be about those lives.
Well, did they start off working as prostitutes because they couldn't find other work?
Well, what attracted them, the stereotype is that you get into it because you're addicted to drugs, or because you're in the thrall of a pimp, or because you've had some childhood trauma or terrible family situation.
You've been molested as a 13-year-old.
Right, and or you've been trafficked from a foreign country and forced into slavery. These are the things that I personally, having no background in this, that I assumed when I first read the reports of the first bodies showing up on the beach. But I was wrong. I mean, there are elements of those things in some of these women's lives, but far and away the deciding factor for each of them in terms of doing this was the money. The money they could make, and seemingly easily, again, remember they're on Craigslist, they don't have to walk down the street or sign up for a pimp, was so dramatically larger than what they could make at the Olive Garden or at Dunkin' Donuts. One of these victims, her mother works at Domino's. Another one is a slot machine attendant at Foxwoods. These are people who their children's lives are very, very limited, and they live in places where the economic recovery has really skipped them over. Now, none of this is set out right in the book. The book is really stories, and through narrative, you can really, learn exactly. You can walk a mile in these women's shoes and see what they went through.
But there was alcohol and drugs. And one of the other things is some of them had gotten pregnant very young.
Certainly that. And, Scott Cunningham is an economist who looks at prostitution, and he talks about economic shocks being things that influence women to enter prostitution, even internet prostitution. And that's one economic shock can be suddenly having a few dependents to pay for.
What happens to their children?
Well, in the case of one of them, they go away for a weekend, and the child has childcare for a weekend while they go off to work. Now, your point about drugs and alcohol is interesting, because I think Kim Overstreet, who's the sister of one of the victims, who's a very colorful character in Lost Girls, she had something interesting to say about that. She said the money you get is the first addiction. You get addicted to the money first, and then maybe the drugs or alcohol comes later, because suddenly you have to, keep working hard and go through a lot of self-denial to keep on being an escort at this level.
So it's self-medication.
Yeah. And, there are people who support sex worker rights or support legalization prostitution who would argue that self-medication happens in a lot of high-pressure fields, whether it's law enforcement or firefighters or air traffic controllers. And that's, I think, something that people might want to keep in mind when they or reconsider when they think about the stereotype of prostitution.
All of them were from small towns. Most of them wound up in big cities like New York.
They came here because that's where the money was. And actually, that's a nuanced point that through the revision of the book I tried to play out, which is that some of them might have started on Craigslist in their local towns and had a little bit more control or felt a little bit more control about who they might be seeing. But as soon as you move to a huge metropolitan area like Long Island or Manhattan, you suddenly are you know, people are seeing your ad from a much larger pool, and there's no telling who might be hiring you.
Are they attracted to the glamour of the big city?
That's an uncomfortable point that I really had to face head on with a few of their stories. I think that for...
Well, you work for New York Magazine.
That's right. I'm a longtime writer at New York Magazine. For a few of these women, this for the longest time solved a lot of their problems at once. It made them powerful. It made them successful. And yes, it made them glamorous. And it made them wealthy enough to send some money back home. It made them closer to their family members than they might have been. And in one case, it made them feel a little bit more responsible, a little bit more like they were putting in their share to support their family.
And that's another cliche, that they disappear from the family. You're saying that it actually brought them closer in some cases.
And that really is the original thing that made me think that their lives were every bit or as more important a focus than as the whodunit in the case. I thought that they were lost long before they were lost. I thought that they were outcasts, you know, because again, the stereotype is, you know, you get out of this house if you do that. But no, in each and every case, all five women that I looked at, they all had very, very close ties to their families. And their families had very close ties to them. Of course, there was an ambivalence there. They didn't want to drive their loved one away by criticizing what they were doing too much.
Where did they live in the city?
Well, you know, Melissa moved from Buffalo, New York, and lived in the Bronx for a few years. Amber lived in North Carolina and then Florida and then came to Long Island for a little while. And then others came in just and stayed in hotels for short periods from places like Portland, Maine and Groton, Connecticut.
Did these girls share certain dreams? Did they have a sense of how their lives might be in the future?
A few of them had general dreams of wanting to, you know, be in show business. Others had a more visceral dream of, you know, wanting a family, wanting to be included in some sort of, you know, their parents had died at a certain point, and they wanted to be part of a sorority of some sort.
Well, in the past, the pimp was often, as you suggested earlier, also the boyfriend and the main source of support. If they got in trouble, they were arrested, the pimp is the one who came and bailed them out. Do they have similar situations with men or women?
There is one example in the book where there's a, you know, what I guess some people would call a Romeo pimp, which is a boyfriend slash pimp, someone who romances a woman and then eventually puts her to work. And the window dressing on the arrangement is that she's making money for the two of them so they can buy a house with a white picket fence and start a family. But in effect, he's pimping her out. And that's a very complicated arrangement and a very complicated woman, Megan Waterman, who I write about in the book.
My guest is Robert Kolker, whose book, Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery, is published by Harper. It's getting wonderful reviews. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Robert Kolker, K-O-L-K-E-R, a New York Magazine contributing editor. His book, Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery, is published by Scribner. So, okay, all of these girls were wound up on Craigslist, or there are other online sites as well, aren't there?
That's right. A couple years ago, Craigslist banned its adult services category, and a lot of prostitutes simply stayed on Craigslist in a, you know, concealed manner, but many more went on to a site called Backpage, which has its own controversial, you know, history since then.
But it's a lot safer, or less, you're less likely to be arrested if you're advertising online.
That's right. And I guess on the higher end, there are escorts who are able to vet their clients because they have a little bit more time and the wherewithal to do so.
Many years ago, I did a Midnight to 5 talk show, and one of my regular callers was a call girl who would report on her adventures. And she described the excitement of walking down that hotel hallway to room 223, not knowing who was on the other side. To me, that would have been terrifying.
I suppose there's an element, you know, they call it sensation-seeking personalities, whether it's people who decide to become cops or firefighters or chase tornadoes or, you know, go into, you know, careers where they meet strangers all of the time.
Now, these girls have to hire a driver. Does he take the place of the pimp?
In some of these cases, the driver has replaced the role of the pimp. They're the sort of hired protection for the evening, and they take something like a third of the earnings, as opposed to the pimp who would take it all.
You also looked into the rules of the out-call visits with men in New York. What are they?
Well, of course, they vary by instance to instance, but you quickly learn that this is a volume-based business, particularly at the level of escorting that I was writing about in the book. So if you have hired yourself out for an hour, you aren't necessarily sticking around for an hour. You're sticking around for as long as, it's practical, and then you simply leave.
So you try to make that as quick as possible.
Right. The women who have drivers, they're putting in a lot of resources, and so they're trying to do as many calls in one night as possible.
And what kind of earnings are we talking about?
Well, that's the amazing thing. On a very busy night, some of these women could make something like $1,500 or $1,200 a night. And that's just undeniably amazing money for the women from the places that I'm talking about.
They all, part of their rules were you only go to certain areas, and mostly they limited themselves to certain parts of Manhattan. So how did they wind up on Long Island?
You're talking about Maureen Brainerd Barnes, who is a very intriguing character in the book. She's one of the victims, and she, developed a whole set of rules and a whole system that she teaches to a friend of hers as they go into New York and they stay in a Midtown hotel. And she plays it very safe and very, very practical right up until the last minute when she breaks one of her own rules and winds up alone. That's how she got to Long Island, although it's not clear exactly how. It seems like a few of these women were picked up in the city and then others were summoned out to Long Island on calls.
These women all have certain things in common in their backgrounds. What about the Johns?
Well, there are all sorts of theories about the Johns. Some say that perhaps it's a retired law enforcement officer, someone who knows how to stay unnoticed for a long period of time and go undetected. The problem with profiling the killer is that everybody has an opinion on it, and they all tend to be very general. Like they say, I think he lives in the area, or he's in his 30s, 40s, or 50s. I mean, it becomes clear from the bound burlap of those first four bodies that this is someone who's doing something with a degree of intention and who is leaving the bodies in a very specific place so that he can remember where they were. That's about as far as I'd go in theorizing about him.
Because most murders are done, are accidental killings, but these obviously were planned as killings.
Yeah, or the disposal at least was, but yes.
The facts of the night of May 1st, 2010, when Shannon was knocking at doors and screaming for help inside this gated community at Oak Beach are still unclear. What is the official reconstruction of the events?
Well, Shannon Gilbert's disappearance in the community of Oak Beach on the South Shore of Long Island is, it's what got a lot of the media attention because it fits most squarely into that Peyton Place, Twin Peaks kind of, small town filled with secrets where everyone knows one another. There's even an element of In Cold Blood going on there. But with a bit of Kitty Genovese thrown in because you have, neighbors who appear at least to be, callous and not particularly care what happens once she disappears the next day.
Do we know whether the killer was the only John she had met that night in Oak Beach?
Well, we know who her John is. He's a man named Joseph Brewer who lived in the community. He says that she was well when she ran out of his house, that she was unharmed, rather, that she was in a panic that he cannot explain or has not explained. She went running, knocked on a lot of doors, and then disappeared. What eventually happened to her wasn't known until months and months later when her body was found in a marsh nearby.
The Kitty Genovese thing is interesting because gated communities are usually places where we expect everybody to be concerned and get along and try to help each other.
Certainly, and I go into a lot of detail about this community in the book to give the book a sense of place so that you understand that Shannon was unlucky enough to disappear in a place so remote and secluded that it was filled with people who were there because they liked being left alone.
Had there been other murder cases in the general vicinity prior to this, to the discoveries?
Well, there had been a few discoveries way out in Manorville and also, you know, elsewhere along Ocean Parkway of, you know, body parts. There was a woman, Jessica Taylor, where parts of her remains were found. She also was an escort a few years earlier.
Were the police pursuing these cases with any vigor?
That much is unclear. The problem with these cases is there are two problems. The first is by the time they find the body, it's a cold case because no one took the disappearance seriously when the woman disappeared. And then the second is there's an institutional bias among a lot of law enforcement that, you know, not victim blaming, but it really verges on that, where they say, well, they put themselves in harm's way. They took the risks. Of course, no one's saying that about any number of other people who break the law, but for some reason, prostitutes get short shrift there.
Doesn't Oak Beach have security cameras?
They do, and it's...
Could they watch her route that night?
You know, there the plot thickens again. No one... Either they aren't telling the truth, or no one looked at that tape before it taped itself over. And of course, the police don't have that tape because they didn't take the disappearance seriously enough or connect the dots soon enough to get it before it taped itself over.
We are talking about the Suffolk County Police Department, which is the 12th largest in the nation. They waited a long time to start a detailed investigation after Shannon Gilbert's disappearance.
Yeah, I want to be even-handed here. I mean, this is an incident that happened in the morning where no one knows what happened to the girl and no one knows what happened to the driver. And so it might have been simple enough for the police officer who responded to say, well, maybe the driver scooped up the girl and drove away, and that's that. Maybe no crime occurred here at all.
And there was no body.
Right, exactly. And only when her missing persons report bubbled up several weeks later did suddenly it seem like something more than that. But that in itself is a problem because various friends and family of Shannon Gilbert's tried to report this disappearance directly to Suffolk County within 24 or 36 hours, and they were rebuffed.
Well, she disappeared on May 1st. The first body was found on December 11th. We are talking about how many months? 7-8 months later.
That's right. And you know, I guess to be fair, if the police didn't care at all about Shannon, they wouldn't have been looking for her. But it was a police officer and his cadaver dog on maneuvers, and when you're on maneuvers training a dog, you like to look into cold cases, who found four bodies 3 miles away from where Shannon was last seen.
And once they started looking, they started looking mostly because of pressure from the media.
Well, that initial discovery of four bodies happened because of the policeman on maneuvers. And then suddenly it was a media maelstrom. I mean, you had all the world descending on Oak Beach in a way that terrified the neighbors and, of course, justifiably spurred the police into action. But then winter came, and they couldn't do much of anything. It was only in the thaw the following March of 2011 that they started to find even more bodies.
And the way the bodies have been buried suggests a serial killer. Does it also suggest that the murderer lives in Long Island?
Well, it is a stretch of road that is not obvious, so you would think that perhaps a local would know about it. And some of those subsequent discoveries, those sets of remains, are linked to remains further out in Manorville, which, again, is another very remote area that you'd have to be a local to understand. So I understand the people who would say that the killer must really know the area back and forth.
Amanda Bartholomew, a sister of one of the victims, received 7 calls from someone who identified himself as the killer of her sister Maureen. Was that investigated?
It's another astonishing twist in this case because it seems like a break in the MO of this killer to expose himself in this way. But it's certainly true that, you know, within days of Melissa Bartholomew's disappearance, her younger sister started to get these phone calls. And it was those phone calls that forced the police to start taking the disappearance more seriously than some of these other women's had. This is back in 2009, and that story actually made the papers in Buffalo, where Melissa is from. But then, of course, nothing came of it until 18 months later when her body was one of the four found in Oak Beach or in Gilgo Beach.
And they were finding other bodies, but they weren't finding Shannon Gilbert's.
Yes, they kept looking and looking, and they kept finding things. And almost automatically, they knew that it wasn't Shannon because she had one very distinguishing characteristic, a titanium plate in her jaw from a surgery that she had had.
So how did they finally find her remains?
Well, the time goes on, and you know, months pass, and the police stop looking at some point, and then they suddenly resume the search in late November, early December, shortly before the commissioner is supposed to retire. And so a lot of people suspect that he's just doing another show of force.
But then he referred to her death as an accident.
Yes, he decided, again, the theories of this case have been all over the place, and it's no wonder now that the Suffolk County Police Department doesn't comment much because they've been changing their story too many times. But as they discovered her body in the marsh nearby, they announced that hers was an accident and just a coincidence, that it wasn't linked to any of the serial killings at all. They said, if you look very closely at Shannon's disappearance, it doesn't fit the MO of the others because she had a driver with her, whereas the others were all lured out on their own. Also, we know who the John was in this case, and so it would have to be an extraordinary coincidence for her to just be out there and happen upon the same killer as the others.
There's another man, Dr. Peter Hackett, who complicates the situation even further.
And, you know, here the story of Lost Girls has an element of Richard Jewell, you know, thrown into it. Richard Jewell, for your listeners who may not remember, is the figure from the Atlanta Olympics bombings who everyone suspected as being responsible for those bombings, when in fact he was sort of the white knight who helped out early on and was considered a hero. Dr. Hackett has a reputation in the community of being very reliable and very upstanding in some ways, but also sort of a busybody and the neighborhood big shot in others. And so he appears to have inserted himself in this situation by calling up Shannon Gilbert's mother early on and saying lots of things to her that made it seem to her, at least, that he had seen her that night. Now he denies having seen her that night. And that difference of opinion really has polluted the whole case. And it becomes clear that there are at least some neighbors who know more than what they're saying about what happened to Shannon that morning.
Hasn't the FBI gotten involved?
The FBI has always been on hand to consult, and they offered some aircraft, particularly to do high-resolution aerial photography. Your listeners may remember all that search for bodies with the, you know, the hook and ladder buckets from the fire department, people staring into the bramble to try to find bodies. Well, the FBI helped out there, too. Shannon's family would like the cold case handed over to the FBI. There are family members of other victims who would like Suffolk County to keep working on it. They have more faith in the police.
Well, do you think that you don't know, but is it likely that this case is going to be solved? They've looked at all the bodies. They've looked at all the forensic evidence. Unless there's another murder, is it likely that anybody could be linked to these?
You know, I'm a reporter, and as soon as this
and then
first,
we're talking about 11 on top of these five. The others weren't in burlap bags, so maybe there's more than one serial killer here.
Totally, there could be more than one, and you know, I'd always thought when those first four were found that the killer would be found in a very, very short amount of time, just like the Craigslist killer up in Boston. But something has happened here where it's like those other serial killer cases where it could take decades.
Robert Kolker's book, Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery, is published by Harper. Mr. Kolker's last name is spelled K-O-L-K-E-R. And the book has gotten great reviews. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming by to talk about this very perplexing case.
Thank you.